This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember chemistry lab? Those precise step-by-step formulas you had to follow? Every ingredient weighed to the gram? Reactions you could only carry out at 46 degrees Celsius using only distilled water? Well, as any home baker might already know, that sort of precision isn't confined to the chemistry lab. Because bread baking is also an exact science. If you want the perfect pumpernickel with this just chewy enough crust and the crumb that isn't, well, crummy, well, then you have to choose the right kind of flour and the right kind of yeast. You have to consider the humidity and the temperature of your kitchen. And, of course, there's that age-old question, to knead or not to knead. Sounds complicated, and that's why we're here to help you sort out the science of bread baking this hour with another episode of Food Failures, why some of your bread baking just doesn't make it. Jack Bishop is editorial director of America's Test Kitchen in Boston. He joins us here in our New York studios. Good to see you again, Jack.
Nice to be here.
What is the biggest failure in bread baking? What do people get wrong the most?
I think the yeast causes the most trouble. People don't understand what yeast is. People don't understand that how to bring it back to life. And they don't know all the things that they can do to kill the yeast and often make those mistakes. And then they end up with a loaf that doesn't rise.
Right.
You know, the biggest mistake the average home cook makes is that they are using old yeast. And it's one of those products where there's an expiration date and it really matters.
Oh, yeah. A Fleischmann packet that says you put it in there and it's you better use it. You put it in the refrigerator, you never think about it again.
Well,
right? First
of all, you put it in the refrigerator. At least you're halfway there. A lot of people put it in the pantry.
Oh, I see.
And you're extending the shelf life by putting it in the refrigerator. And that expiration date assumes that it's in the refrigerator and it really means something. If you use yeast that's 6 months past its use by date, you're just probably going to get a compromised rise or no rise at all.
Because it's a living thing.
Well, it's in suspended animation.
Right.
It's a living thing that you need to bring back to life. But at some point, you can't bring it back to life because it's been, you know, past the point of no return.
Mm-hmm. Well, our number is 844-724-8255. We're talking about the science of bread baking. Let's talk about the ingredients. You have your bread flour, your all-purpose bleached, unbleached, enriched. I could go on, right? Well, what's basically the difference between all of these flours?
Protein content. So different varieties of wheat have different protein contents. And at the top of the range, you would have bread flour. It's about 13% protein. The rest of it's basically starch.
Mm-hmm.
At the low end, you've got cake flour, maybe 6 or 7% protein. In the middle, all-purpose, which is the name implies.
Right.
You can use it for a lot of things. It's 10 to 11%. And this will vary from brand to brand. Some brands have a little bit more flour than protein than others. And that really is what's going to give you structure. And so high protein you want for bread because it's what's going to give you crust and crumb and chew, and you'll be able to sink your teeth into it. For a tender cake, it's the last thing you want. You don't want a tough cake with a really hearty crust. You want it to be tender, so you're using low-protein cake flour when you're making a cake.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about gluten. We hear about gluten, gluten-free all the time. What exactly is gluten?
So there are two proteins in wheat flour, glutenin and gliadin, and they are basically inert until you add water. And so when you hydrate the flour, you bring them back to life. They unwind. They're sort of wound around the starch.
Mm-hmm.
And then they attach to each other. And the more you knead, the more they attach. And they develop a membrane that's very elastic that's called gluten. So gluten is basically the end game of these two proteins. When they get hydrated in the flour, form a very elastic network that is the thing that gives rise to bread. If you didn't have gluten, you'd have basically, you know, a cracker rather than than a baguette.
And that's a food failure, right? That's absolutely a food failure.
That is a food failure.
You brought with you today a demonstration of gluten and how important it is. What are we looking at? What have you got on the table here?
So we wanted to actually try to touch gluten.
Right.
And so we took measured amounts of flour, 500 grams of flour. We took 340 grams of water and made a dough with just the flour and the water. We then put it in a chinois, fine mesh strainer, and washed it. You know, if you make rice for rice pilaf, you often wash the starch away. You know, that cloudy water turns right. clear. And basically, we were doing the same thing, trying to wash out all of the starch, because mostly that's what's in flour, so that we'd be just left with the gluten. And so I have two balls there. That is what's left over. The one that you are touching and that is actually quite sticky
is
bread flour.
And reminds me of pizza dough or something.
Yeah, and it's even, I mean, you can try to pull it apart. It's really, it's almost taffy-like.
Oh, yeah.
And the smaller, I don't even think it looks like cottage cheese, is what is left over when you do the same thing.
It's like a little like oatmeal or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of cheesy, yeah.
And that's what you get from cake flour. And that the gluten is not only you get less gluten because there's a less protein, but it's very weak gluten. It's not nearly as strong as that bread flour, in part because cake flour is generally bleached, and the bleaching damages the proteins so that they're not able to form the gluten as readily.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have a microwave here.
I see that.
So I'm going to put the microwave on. So we wanted to demonstrate the elasticity of gluten, and there are two ways to do that. One is we actually attached the raw gluten to a helium tank and blew it up, and you can blow it up like a balloon, like at a child's party.
And it'll float in the air?
It'll float in the air.
It's that full of air normally, but this one is helium.
Yes. I thought it would be more reliable. You can also add energy. And so we took a ball of gluten and put it in the microwave, and this is, as you can see...
Wow. Wow. Look at the size of that.
So that is, I don't know...
Wait, how would you... It's almost like the size of a football.
Yeah. I think it's 10 or 20 times the size of the ball that went into the microwave. And
see how crispy that is.
Yeah, and it has a kind of... It smells like popcorn or bread.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It has an aroma. And the point is that it is incredibly elastic. And if you add heat, energy, you pump in air, you can expand it. And that when you add yeast, now remember that there was no yeast in that ball, but when you're making bread, you're adding yeast, which is, of course, the source
right.
of the air.
Right.
And the gluten is trapping all of that carbon dioxide that is produced by the yeast.
Mm-hmm. And how do you make sure that this actually blows up like this? What could be a food failure or not to have the food failure that you don't get the gluten working like this?
Well, one of the things that people often do is the temperature of the liquid's too hot. And so, you know, the first failure is you're using old yeast. The second is you then kill it. You know, the yeast was fine, but then you're a murderer, so to speak. And you let the dough get too warm, and you do that by adding liquid that is too warm. And so generally at around 115, 120 degrees, that temperature liquid will start to slow down the yeast. At 140, you've killed it. And so if you add hot water to a dough, that's not a good thing. The other thing that's really important is, depending on the temperature of the water, you get different flavor profiles that are developing in the yeast.
Right.
And generally, the cooler the water, the better the flavor. You get less of those sort of acidic sour notes
right.
in the fermentation process, and you get more of those sort of delicious bready notes.
That's what you want.
Yep. Using room temperature water in general, it will take more time. You know, people add
right.
the warm water or the hot water because they want to speed up the
yeah.
process,
yeah.
but it's risky, and the end results are not as good.
Speaking of water, we have Bob on the line from Silver Spring. He has a question about water. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Science Friday.
Okay. First of all, I'm a PhD organic chemist, so I understand most of this. I bake the same thing using the same ingredients. I actually bring some of the yeast with me, keeping it cold, from Maryland. I go to Florida, and it doesn't work. And until I brought water from New York...
You're asking the old New York water. Is that why a bagel is better? Because
yeah,
it's got New York water?
Washington water will work. But I'm wondering, how critical can it be? Because, I mean, I keep the rooms at this approximately the same temperature. The humidity may differ. But is there something in the air that's killing the yeast? Because when I proof it, it just doesn't want to go.
All right.
But if I use New York water, it rises beautifully.
Jack?
The water makes a big difference. The simple rule is if you don't like the taste of your water that comes out of your tap, you should not be using it in the bread. And there are two things. You can get that sort of off chlorine flavor imparted to a simple bread. I mean, this is less of an issue if you're making like brioche with a lot of eggs and butter, but if you're making a baguette, for instance. The second thing is the mineral content, and that can really give you some performance issues. One last theory is the ambient conditions in the kitchen are much more important than most people recognize.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not in a lab, but I do keep the thermostat at the same temperature.
Well, the humidity can be affecting your flour.
Yeah.
And that your flour in a pantry in Miami is very different than flour in a pantry in Phoenix, for instance. And so that's something just to be thinking about in terms of how readily the flour is going to absorb the liquid that you're adding.
Well, again, I try to keep the flour sealed. By the way, the flour, the house brand of Target, their regular all-purpose unbleached is 4% protein, not 3%.
Okay. And good luck.
Is that necessarily gluten, or could be the other one?
So gluten is formed from the two proteins, which are glutenin, so it's gluten with an I-N at the end, and gliadin. Yeah. And so those two things, when they're combined, they're called gluten, and they're in all wheat flours.
Yeah, I realize, but there's a little more there. I think it's made somewhere else because there's also half a gram of fat in it.
There you go. All right. Thanks for coming.
Strike up one for New York water.
There you go. A lot of people say that about the bagels all the time, right? Why are New York bagels better? It's the water. But do you find that? You're a New Yorker. Do you find that to be different?
Yeah. The water in New York is much better than the water in most of the rest of the country, especially city water. Where our test kitchen is in Boston, the water is really pretty awful, and we use bottled water when we're serious about the bread rather than using the tap water because, again, in a baguette, you can taste the difference because the tap water just isn't very – it's got a lot of chlorine in it, and it just doesn't taste very
good.
Could
chlorine kill the yeast at all?
I don't think the chlorine is going to kill the yeast, but it's just going to give the bread an aroma that's not very appetizing.
I agree. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk lots more with Jack Bishop, Editorial Director of America's Test Kitchen in Boston. If you've got questions about your food failures baking bread, give us a call at number 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday. We're talking with Jack Bishop, Editorial Director of America's Test Kitchen in Boston. And we're talking about food failures this week, and the food failure being, why isn't my bread baking working? What am I doing wrong? We try to give a scientific remedy for it, the chemistry, this physics also in bread baking. We have a tweet coming in who says, Jason Sater says, is high gluten flour the same as bread flour?
No. High gluten flour is especially flour that's not sold at supermarkets. It's used by commercial bakers. You can mail order it. It has about a 14% protein content rather than the 12 to 13% protein content in bread flour. It is a must for something like a bagel. In general, we don't actually think it adds a lot to a lot of other recipes like a boule, a ciabatta, where you think the bread flour is often the better choice. But for a bagel, you need the high gluten flour, and you're going to need to mail order it or have a friend at a bakery who will give you some.
Wow. What about people who can't tolerate the gluten? They need gluten-free breads. Can you make gluten-free breads?
You can, as long as you basically throw out everything you know about making traditional breads. You need, first of all, a gluten-free flour blend. We actually developed a blend recently in the test kitchen that has brown and white rice flours, tapioca starch, potato starch, and milk powder as the five ingredients that we use to replace the flour. And then you need more protein. So you have to add eggs, even to recipes that normally wouldn't have an egg. Mm-hmm. And you need to add baking powder and yeast because you're not going to get enough lift from just using the yeast. The gluten-free flours are very low in protein, and the protein that gets formed is pretty weak. And so in order to get a real loaf of bread, you need to add a lot of lift and a lot of protein.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. Folks, want their bread problems solved, like Wilbur in Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bread that I bake out of the More With Less cookbook. It's an herb bread that has onions in it, but it never seems to rise as well as other breads that I make, and I'm just wondering, does onions or garlic in a bread do things to the yeast so it doesn't work as well?
Is it killing the yeast?
I don't know that it's I don't think there's anything going on at a chemical level. I think if depending on the amount of onions, it may just simply be some physics of weighing down the loaf. And so the question I would ask is what size are those pieces and how well they're distributed? And that, you know, if you try pureeing the onions or mincing them very fine, do you get the flavor with a sort of better rise? Because when you put nuts in and seeds, you're basically puncturing kind of the carbon dioxide that develops, and that the more stuff you add to a loaf, whether it's onions or nuts, the harder it is for it to rise.
Hope that answers your question, Wilbur.
Yes, it does.
Good luck.
Thanks.
If you live in Denver or high up in the mountains, does it affect the loaf or shape of your bread? Because, you know, higher pressure, lower pressure, is it going to be a more gas bubble inside?
Once you get above 3,000 feet, baking changes radically. And the two things that are happening are, first of all, it's usually very dry once you get up there. And so that's affecting the flour. And then, as you said, the way heat works, the way rise works. And, you know, we're at about 5 feet above sea level at our test kitchen, and we actually sent somebody to spend a month out in Boulder.
Oh, is that right?
Well, because
like 7,000 feet,
because how do you replicate it unless you go do it?
Right.
And she spent a lot of time baking a wide variety, everything from cakes, cookies, yeast breads. You have to make all kinds of adjustments, often adding more liquid, changing the baking times, changing the rising times, and it, you know, 3,000 feet is different than 7,000 feet, which is the hard part about giving any specific recommendations.
Before I go to the phones, there are some cookbooks that tell you to add the yeast first, then wait a bit, then add the salt a little bit later. Is there any reason for doing that?
If you mix them directly together, the salt will kill the yeast. We like to add the yeast and the water and the flour and let everything sort of sit for 20 minutes. It's a process called autolyse. And basically what you're doing is reducing the kneading time. You're allowing the water and the enzymes in the proteins in the flours to sort of do some of the work that kneading does for you.
What is the purpose of kneading? What's going on inside the bread when you knead it?
So there are these two proteins that are very tightly coiled in the dry flour, and then when they're hydrated, they're sort of unwinding and bonding together. And the more you knead, the more you're developing that network and helping them literally to hook up together, and the stronger you're making the gluten. Now, the problem is that the more you knead, at some point you ruin the flavor. You're oxidizing the dough, and that you can actually, especially with a stand mixer, this is not a problem that existed until probably 50 years ago, but stand mixers, these powerful electric mixers, you can over-knead the dough and you sort of bleach the flavor out. You oxidize the flavor out. And so a lot of recipes that are for the stand mixer call for this thing called autolyse. It's a 20-minute rest. And basically, it facilitates the development of the gluten without you having to touch the dough. We then go ahead, add the salt, turn the mixer on, and begin the kneading process. And it'll cut the kneading time by about a third. So we've done tests. And if you don't do that step, it'll be 15 minutes. And if you do that step, it's 10 minutes. And the bread tastes better kneaded the 10 minutes. And it's to the same degree in the sense we're kneading it until the dough clears the sides of the bowl.
Right.
It just happens faster if you let the flour and the yeast and the water rest for 20 minutes.
You know, get the exercise if you're not kneading the bread. Let's go to the phones because we have lots of people who would like to ask to talk about it. I didn't think bread baking was going to be this popular. We're all lit up. Let's go to Louisa in Interlochen, Michigan. Hi.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I'm not very good at baking bread, but I do have a bread maker machine. And when I put my ingredients in there and it comes out, it doesn't adhere very well together. It's very crumbly. So what am I doing wrong?
Those machines, those electric bread bakers, are okay as kneading and proofing devices. They're not very good as baking devices. And I think if you're somebody who's really struggled with getting good loaf, I suggest you try a recipe, our version of a recipe that was popularized by the New York Times. It's a
Where can they get your recipes?
You can go to cooksillustrated.com, americastestkitchen.com. The recipes, we called almost no need bread. When the Times published it, they called it no need bread. We actually knead it for 15 seconds. But the trick is it bakes in a Dutch oven. And that covered environment of the Dutch oven traps steam. You get a really great crust. And it's kind of one step away from the bread machine. Mm-hmm. It's really reliable. It's kind of goof-proof. And I feel like you get a better rise. You get a better crust. The baking in the electric bread machines just isn't very good.
Okay, so it's probably the baking of it, actually. And there it's like it could knead it, maybe, but not. But then remove it and bake it a different way, and I'd have better luck.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, if you, instead of using a stand mixer, you can combine the ingredients in there. And we really like it for proofing, for rising, because it traps the humidity. You know, you have these proofing boxes in a professional bakery that trap heat and humidity. And in some ways, the bread machine is kind of like that and does a nice job of letting the dough rise, especially if you've got a cold, drafty kitchen. It's really nice to do it in a bread machine. But I would take it out and try baking it in a Dutch oven, preheated Dutch oven.
Thank you. Thank you, Louisa. Thanks for calling. What is the secret to making good pizza at home like you get at the pizza place? Is it the temperature? Is it the dough? Is it having it on the slate? Is it having a coal-fired oven? What is the secret? What are some of the secrets?
It's the right dough, and it's a baking stone. If you do not have a ceramic pizza stone or a baking stone, you just really can never get the kind of crust that you can get when you go out. Mm. You know, a baking sheet just doesn't – the heat transfer is not good enough. The baking stone can spend an hour in a 500-degree oven preheating, and then you use a pizza peel to get the dough on there, and it just – the heat transfer is much, much better. And then the dough. We make the dough and put it in the refrigerator for a couple of days and let cool fermentation slowly develop the flavors. It also gets a lot easier to work with. You know, a lot of people really fight the pizza dough in terms of trying to stretch it and roll it.
Yeah.
Let it spend a day, 2 days, even 3 days in
no
the fridge.
Kidding.
It'll be so much better behaved. It'll roll out nicely. You won't have to put so much flour on it to get it to roll out, and it'll be a better end product.
And if you want to throw it up in the air, is it easier? Do it that way.
Sure. If you like taking risks, throw it in the air.
This is New York. You have to throw up in the air or it's not real pizza. Thank you, Jack. This is great. And where can we get some more hints about bread baking? On your website.
Go to cooksillustrated.com, americastestkitchen.com. We've got all kinds of videos and recipes where people can learn more about bread baking.
Always good to have you, Jack, with all the bread stuff, too.
Thank you.
Jack Bishop is editorial director of America's Test Kitchen in Boston.